Okay, we're at 91.
91. There's the 2 cents.
Oh, that's what he's talking about.
I'm guessing because he talked about them being in cones. Those are the only cones I've seen in the whole deal.
So that's 91.
There's a lower cone and an upper cone. The upper cone's kind of rounded, I would say. Do you think it still looks like a cone? I guess I do.
I'm assuming that it is from his description.
So I was thinking, you know, we got two stars and we got two suns. So do you think I talked about the two stars as the soul and the self, and then maybe the two suns as consciousness and then the light of nature?
It could be. Well, if we go with the idea we've had that this was, you know, the spirit, and this was matter.
Which was spirit? I'm sorry.
Well, remember that because of the Christian link.
So would that be a conscious kind of thing?
Well, yeah.
Okay. That's 91. Now that black thing has made the roof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talks about putting the sun, putting a roof over the sun.
I see.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So those black and gold pieces are reforming again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then that blue seems to sort of squirt out the sides of the mandala a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And now we still have the world in the center, and it's containing the other star, right? The second star.
Yeah, but still containing it, yeah.
The world.
But it had a nice warm center in the previous, and now it's getting a little bit, as this war between lower and upper.
If you look at the one beforehand, at the world in the center of the cell. Gary, could you go back one, please? See how the black and gold are just floating around?
Yeah, and prior to that, they were formed, right?
It's almost like it's breaking up and coming back together.
Yeah, forming and reforming.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Now in the next one, if you'll advance to 91, you see those black and gold specks in the center of that world are now forming a star
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, when I thought about the upper and lower sun, I was thinking of maybe sun equals the dynamism of those two elements. Or perhaps the suns are the dynamism of the two stars. The energy of the two stars,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. Now the blue star and the black star have merged.
Mm-hmm.
Those two stars came together.
Mm-hmm.
And have exploded.
Yeah, they really blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Or blew out.
And we don't see a lot of black and gold except in the very center. So it's not wandering all over.
Yeah, it's covered. It's centered.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like that upper sun has stabilizes it and eases up on its downward force. Visually. If you go back, maybe it becomes clearer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's got more force and then
mm-hmm. it's heavier.
Then go forward and then not quite as much force.
Mm-hmm.
And then that lower sun is all contained. It doesn't have that upward force going.
Mm-hmm.
And then that black really takes on the shape of that tablet.
Yep.
What did you call the tablet? the thing that manifests in the world. You're speaking of the rings.
Oh well, yeah. The well.
I guess
really,
it doesn't really.
Synchronicity. The force, they capture the force that creates synchronicity.
That
the runes capture whatever it is that makes synchronicities possible or happen.
Now the upper and lower suns equalize.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one wavy line coming out of the star.
And he, I think that must be the serpent way that he mentions in the footnote. Mm-hmm. The middle way appears as that wavy line. And the star center is golden.
It's funny, the mandala has gotten smaller and the world's gotten bigger.
And he talks about a bridge. Is that the pattern?
That's what I was wondering.
It reminds you of the Native American Rainbow Bridge.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But he hasn't gone to the Pueblos yet. Is that right?
Right.
He goes in the 20s or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now we see sort of suggested those runes up there at the center of that, say, rainbow bridge. Do you see them, Gary?
I was wondering if it was my imagination or whether they're there.
They're there.
Mm-hmm.
They're really very obvious in the book.
Are they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like they've got incorporated into life somehow.
Mm-hmm. Now, he makes a big deal of those little hook shapes coming away from the star. He talks about those in footnote 157, and that's what I think he's referring to. He calls them a rune. He says, then both of you move upward and one. This is, he talks about the bridge. That's what the serpent crawls at the top and draws the sun up. Then both of you move upward and one to go to the upper. And then he makes that, he draws that rune. I think that must be what he's referring to when he talks about that little shape.
He's talking about the black lines between the red.
Well, you know that little, had that hook line coming away from the red?
Yeah.
I think that's what he's referring
to.
And he does talk about that bridge in this footnote, too.
Is that 57?
Yeah, 157.
157, yeah.
So that's really, we're talking about 93 and 95 there? Because you talked earlier that...
That's not, what are we at, 93.
Well, that bridge sort of turns into an I, right? In the next one?
And now we see more manifestation of the runes that were in that very first cone at the bottom.
Yes. Okay.
Hang on a second. Maybe I was wrong there. I don't know. Maybe the image 93 is discussed in the 156, because I didn't see the runes there before. I don't.
He talks about runes in both 56 and 57.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That, 94?
94.
Are we supposed to think of the what's down in the field of the eye and what was preceding it, I mean, the wavy line that preceded the picture as water.
This, you mean?
Yeah, that, or you go back to the one before or something. What are all the...
Well, we've had those shapes quite a bit.
Yeah,
oh, he finally explains them.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, in what he thinks of them. In image 105, the footnote about it.
Okay, that's way ahead of us, huh?
It's a little bit ahead of us. But he says what they are. He...
good. Yeah, that was my question.
He calls them the creative forces. So they are, as we had thought, his book, it's a vocabulary of the unconscious and shapes. Yeah, he calls them the creative forces.
They seem to be under kind of like a wavy line, almost a water line.
I guess it's indicating that they come from the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was thinking about art and what's the, what do you call that line? That's
the horizon line.
Horizon line.
But
whatever is above is conscious,
whatever is below. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in the center, the blue star is the same that looks like from here, the same bead that's in the triangle cone thing that goes up.
You think it's the same blue?
It looks like from here. It looks like
you mean this blue is the same as this blue?
I don't think so.
Blue.
I mean, the very center.
To me, more similar to the creative content below that ripple wavy line, or somehow then coming
that's
up and
thought.
Making the bridge.
That's a thought, you know, that center is, you know, forming a sort of eye or consciousness that translates that, create those creative forces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I almost saw that. Top wavy line and the bottom wavy line is maybe like a spirit of the time, spirit of the depth, so he is pulling together close historical force, close historical kind of thing, as well as the spiritual one.
Is it not well as much what?
People want.
Okay.
The next one where we have the eye form, now we don't have the suns anymore. So that conflict between those two aspects, this is somehow a resolution.
I think for sure we're seeing a birth of something big. I wanted to look what's ahead, but I wonder if almost we're getting to the beginning of the end. How many more chapters do we have? Page-wise, but chapter-wise.
You mean before we get to
eight,
the scrutiny?
Before we get to the scrutiny, eight chapters.
Eight more.
But some of them are extremely long.
Oh, long.
The magician, that one, really, really long.
Okay. That's all I can do to keep up with where we are.
But then in the next one, the suns come back.
But
like
really,
very
it's a
different.
Skeletal.
They're runes now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're abstract.
Symbols.
See, there's the tree.
Abstract.
Right.
I think I'm just so pleased that I figured that out.
The tree?
Yeah. That the tree is that we were really dealing with two double conflicts, and the tree is coming between them.
And if you see, there are four branches of roots.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. even better.
If it was 95, but we should be on 97, right?
What? 95.
95. Oh. In the bottom, black and white image, yes, it looks like the menorah.
Mm-hmm. And now the above one has become like a flame to me.
Mm-hmm. There's those. Major change.
Mm-hmm. Now that looks like a Navajo sand painting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And his blue star has a white border now.
Mm-hmm.
Those lines remind me of the glyph for Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that Aquarian energy is, you know, being exchanged in the four directions.
And here too, I think we've got circling and square, where the star is held around that, it begins to look square-like, and then the circle around
it. And the lines from the top are the same color as the
Now, what did you say before, last time, about the color, the purple, the symbolism of the purple?
Well, let's see, what was that? It was lavender, and it was against another color.
Okay.
What was that color it was against as its background?
White?
It was a color.
Do you want to go back?
I don't even know which image it was.
How far?
But whatever I think it was one of the historiated initials, was it?
Oh, that could be.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was there. Is that it? Right back here.
The snake?
Yeah. It was
right.
What image number is it?
That the lavender looks weak.
71. Against the
white primary colors. Or if you follow color theory, you'd say, well, the lavender, which is what I take
to do with it. Went ahead.
Stop!
There you go.
Remember, he said that was Tony and he and them.
And so now, in this, wherever we were, now we have purple, but you said something about that being weak, the lavender.
Yeah.
And now it's
purple.
So the connections before it's that lavender was connections between the stars, or like the connections between the archetypes that make the dynamism of the self.
And for me, then you have in the next one the roots. Oh no, before. Go back one, Gary. The roots are now branching out along the horizon, so
seeing
a broader, a much broader view of his place in the world.
Exactly, maybe realizing he does have a place.
He still has that lavender against the red, which really bothers me.
Oh, in the lower one.
Why?
In the center.
Oh, in the center.
Why does it bother you?
Color-wise, it bothers me.
Oh.
Color symbolism-wise.
What would it mean, color symbolism-wise?
I'm going to be sick to my stomach. kind of feeling. Oh. Well, we had that before, with the lavender and the red together. And
that's bad, huh?
I'm just saying, what do you think? Color symbolism-wise, does that bother you?
It's kind of off-putting.
It is, isn't it?
Jarring.
It's a little nauseating to me. I have to look away.
I don't know. I find a golden pink and kind of bothersome too, but I don't know if it's special. The others are more harmonious and more complementary.
Well, something has to be done.
Yeah, you know, and I think that happens in the very next conference. To me, it felt like everything was converging. All those lines above and below were converging and into this. And I don't know if that makes sense or not. It worked for me.
Yes,
it's a lot of energy were deposited.
Yeah. Yes,
and
it all
and then.
Right.
Okay, now we're a little better. Color theory wise. I can look at that. See, now it's got more of a violet, a blue-violet tone. That's much better.
That's what people are wearing today, don't you think? They're wearing the strangest colors together.
I don't know.
No? Okay.
I don't know.
That sheep is more like an egg.
Yeah, that's the egg again.
Sure.
See, I see it more as the prototype for something we're going to see later on. The human head. Remember that later on.
Coming up?
No, it's quite a way.
Oh, I don't go ahead.
Okay.
Me neither.
All right.
I go about 3 pages ahead. I guess so.
Yeah, it does.
But the rift in the sun, I mean, now all the energies have become more equalized or something in this one, it seems. And those elaborations in the center, I guess I'm going to call them, they've got the alchemical colors.
The way the lines are back.
Now I see, before we had 2 suns, the conflict of the 2, and now I see we have the conflict of the 4.
Yeah.
The 4 suns.
Yeah, I think I was okay to say what I said about 2 and 2.
So too.
Yeah. And this is why it's been so confusing. We've generated a higher level of complexity, and we had to have a higher level of chaos before we got there. And really, it's a good lesson for therapy. You know, one gets in these phases of the process, and nothing makes sense anymore. And the great danger is giving up instead of staying with it, knowing how this process works is. The more profound the end point, the longer and more confusing the road to it. But that damn rational mind wants clarity, it wants to see a goal. It can't live with uncertainty and confusion. I actually had one of the most unpleasant people I've ever worked with. Cognitive behavioral therapist would say to me, now we're on Dream 74. I don't feel any better than when I was on Dream 70.
Good.
It didn't work, as you can imagine. Okay, well, not bad. Thanks for your help.
I mean, I think there's so much. I mean, we're individuals, you know, and there's so much that comes out there speaking to him, the individual, that we couldn't possibly fathom.
Right. Really, almost makes me want to not do this, but I figure, you know, like when we did Number and Time, I said to myself and to the group, don't worry about what you don't understand. Be happy with what you do understand. And I think you have to approach difficult material just trying to get something, knowing you're missing a lot. But that doesn't mean that what you've got is wrong. I think what we've got here is a foreshadowing of the four coming into one.
Now all of these were done in a sense from hindsight on his part, right? I mean these images came after he'd had a chance to meditate and digest his text.
Yeah.
Otherwise I would give him even more latitude. I'd say, well, you know, he's doing the same kind of inventing that he's been doing in his texts. Whatever comes to his head, you know, comes to his hand and his sense of design. But it's obvious that he's had a chance to think about it and meditate on it.
Yeah, but what you said comes to his hand, I would give priority. Did I ever tell you about that woman I met here who worked with Jung? I've often kicked myself for not, but I don't know why I did the right thing. Anyway, when I first moved here, I met a woman who said my mom worked with Jung. And I met the lady. She was well in her 90s, and she had painted herself out of what's that skin disease? Eczema. She had a crippling case of eczema. Went to Jung, and he cured it. Or they cured it. And she had all the paintings she did around her room. All my colleagues were saying, oh, you should get those paintings, write them up. And it just felt invasive. But unfortunately, many good paintings have been lost to history. I have no idea whatever happened to her. Oh, she obviously is dead by now, I'm sure. She was 90 then. But we had a little talk, and I said, what was it like working with Jung? And she said, he said to me, your reason you have eczema is your hands want to express something. Let them paint out what they want to express. And as she did it, the eczema went away. Now, so I'm wondering if he didn't take what he had mentally observed and then let his hands go. I don't know how much he would have thought this out, but rather let his hands think it out.
Do you think some of these illustrations were originally in those black books?
Yes.
Sketches, I imagine.
Yeah. Do you know which ones, how they were in there exactly, there and here, or?
No clue. They just had some of them open, some of the black books.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
And
you could see this. So some were even done in color.
So he's reproduced some of the black book images in his red book.
And were they done carelessly,
exactly,
quickly, or very carefully?
No, very carefully.
But smaller, maybe?
Yeah.
Where did you see these?
In the museum where they were exhibited.
The Rubin.
The Rubin Museum. They're gone now, but I don't know. It was an amazing exhibit. Oh, amazing. There were actually four levels in the museum, and the bottom level, he was in the bottom level, and I love that. And then the Buddhist level was at the top.
He was in New York.
Yeah. Private museum.
Is this the group of mandalas that he talks about that he produced while he was in service? He made one every day. Is that this group?
I don't know, Carol.
Oh, no, we said, because that would have been 97. Well, that's true. If you did it later.
There might be some overlap, but I thought he just sketched them out of a little notebook.
And he talks about black book 7. I thought they were only 6. That was my question. Well, there must have been 7 or more.
Okay, should we move on? Maybe lights again? We're on page 292.
Okay.
Now, what I think we have is we're going to be developing the other side of that little chart I made.
What side is that?
The Christianity side. See, we've had the sun, we've had power, we've had evil, we've had serving, slaying or creating God. And I have understood that anyway, is all the stuff in the lower part of those pictures. And now we're going to start with Christianity. And Christianity is going to appear as a saving grace and as a problem. And we'll be wrestling with that duality for a while. And then that will, in effect, be confronting what we've already just done. And then we have images of growth that follow. So I don't know if we need to go through every line here, because the basic idea is rather general. What he does, he gets a book of Thomas A. Kempis's Imitation of Christ, a medieval tractate. I got to tell you, even when I was in divinity school, that was a big book. Basically, what Thomas says is to be a Christian means to be like Christ. And we had these guys in school who were like, you know, trying to imitate the life of Christ. And the holier you were, the more you were like Christ. And the more unsufferable I found you. But you know, good and light and always compassionate and always giving, always sharing.
Christ had his temper tantrums, didn't he?
Huh? Well, I had the temper tantrums, and they weren't.
You had them for him.
Yeah, I had them for them,
right?
Yeah. So, see, what he's doing now, what a shift this is from everything he's just gone through. He's talking about being God, creating God, evil, and all of a sudden he's thinking, well, now maybe I should be like Christ. That's pretty much page 292. A couple of things he says which are ancillary. Look in the second column of 292. You know that I value science extraordinarily highly, but there are actually moments in life where science also leaves us empty and sick. Everything he's just said on the left, that fits the worldview of science. It's nothing mysterious. And then another point, but this is old-fashioned, Thomas's stuff. We can no longer get involved in Christian dogmatics these days, surely.
Is that the
that's the librarian.
Guy that says
yeah.
that?
And now, I think a very important sentence. We haven't come to an end with Christianity by simply putting it inside. It seems to me that there's more to it than we see. So, he's added complexity to the pot by saying, I don't see how what I've just said fits with everything I've said for the last 20 pages, but I know we can't get rid of Christianity. We'll see in a moment, he also will say, and I can't accept it either. So a new conflict has started. And remember, after the war, I think every European intellectual said Christianity is nonsense. Freud, Marx, the existentialists. But he's not willing to let it go. Though he's also not willing to accept it on its own terms either. And that's the main idea. So let's just look at some particulars. He talks about Nietzsche on 293. Nietzsche, you remember, said God is dead. And Jung certainly felt, I think Nietzsche was the most important philosopher of the 19th and 20th centuries. And, of course, blasted Christianity. And then, so Jung says, middle of the first column, 293, as I said, there seem to be all sorts of things in Christianity that maybe one would do well to keep. Nietzsche is too oppositional. More of the same, but just to hear some of his sentence. The first column where it says, point two, the divine wants to live with me.
Where are you again?
Page 293, first column where it says brackets number two. What a far cry it is from I create God. But the only way he has to frame that at the moment is to take Christ as a model. Which he doesn't accept. Look at the last paragraph, second line, last paragraph of the first column on 293. Second line. You can certainly leave Christianity, but it does not leave you. Your liberation from it is delusional. Christ is the way. So that's one side. One side says, I'm not going to throw out Christianity. There's much in Christianity that I accept. I want to serve God. But all I know is the imitation of Christ. Then comes the other side. The first full paragraph of the second column, 293. If I imitate Christ, he is always ahead of me, and I can never reach the goal. Bam, comes the other side. What he just saying to himself, what I just said is impossible.
I don't see him conflicting himself like that. It seems like a seamless thought.
Well, but I believe they are conflicting ideas. I mean, we have to then bring consciousness in and see the conflict.
What do you see as conflicting in this line of thought?
That he is talking about Christianity as imitating Christ, and he just realizes that that's a hopeless venture.
Right.
So that's a conflict.
And how's that conflicting?
Because what he just said is, I'm looking to Christianity as a solution, but it's an impossible solution.
No, he finds it.
He finds it eventually, but only after he goes back and forth.
When he meditates on the true nature of what it means to imitate Christ,
Right, but see, he hasn't been meditating on the true nature. He's been repeating the Christian message without reflection. Mm. Only in the next paragraph does he begin to interpret what he's just said. See, we've got to be attentive to the conflicts in our own statements.
I see where he makes it a conflict, like you say. In that sentence, starting in the second paragraph, the right-hand column. Initially, I wanted to emulate and imitate Christ by living my life while observing his precepts.
Mm-hmm.
A voice in me protested against this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I see what you're saying.
read that whole thing. If I imitate Christ, he is always ahead of me, and I can never reach the goal unless I reach it in him. But thus I move beyond myself and beyond time, and through which I am as I am. I thus blunder into Christ and his time, which created him thus and not otherwise, and so I am outside my time, despite the fact that my life is in this time and I am split between the life of Christ and my life that still belongs to this present time. But if I am truly to understand Christ, I must realize how Christ actually lived only his own life and imitated no one. He did not emulate any model. So he starts to realize there is a way out of this mess. If I thus truly imitate Christ, I do not imitate anyone. I emulate no one, but go on my own way, and I will also no longer call myself a Christian. And so on. What Carol read there. So, see, what's going to come out of this is the inner Christ. And that to live a religious life isn't to become like Christ, but with the same devotion that Christians want to become like Christ, Jung is looking at a process whereby we become ourselves. And so we don't emulate Christ. We do see Christ as, we do see the self as having the same demand on us that Christ has on the traditional Christian, and we have to fulfill its demands. And then, interestingly, the way that is often symbolized is by an image of Christ. The self appears as an image of Christ. And that the image of Christ that we've been given is incomplete. So all of that stuff he wrote two or three books about comes up right here. And that's how he could not throw out Christianity, but also not succumb to its errors. So it's the beginning of his reinterpretation of religion.
That's very much the Grail task, isn't it?
It sure is. I think von Franz, I almost remember the sentence, that the Grail task is to find in what form the essence of Christ is alive in this age. It's always reinterpreting. As he says, if you live like Christ, how do you pay your mortgage? How do you put your kids through college? What do you do if you're in love with two women? I think that's pretty much that chapter. I think it might be a place to stop. We pick up with Nox Secundum, and so how'd you read to 295? I want you to read to 298. You read to 295, right? So it's three pages. We probably won't get that far. But what I, just to anticipate, you know, it's not over yet. He starts out, oh, I should imitate the life of Christ. I can't imitate the life of Christ. He's going to go back because another person who is reading the imitation of Christ is a cook in the next chapter. So that's where nourishment will come from. So he's back there. And this is what's going to happen. He's going to go back and forth a couple of times. That's why I called that secondhand column another presentation of conflict. But then out of all of that is going to come a death and then a new growth. which I think we could say was anticipated in these pictures. But we'll see. I don't think we get to the, only in the next chapter after that do we start getting another death, because this conflict can't be resolved in the way it's been presented. A new synthesis has to germinate, and for that new synthesis to germinate, there has to be a relinquishing of always trying to figure it out. But only after you've worked until you can't figure it out anymore. That's the trick. Okay, everyone still alive?
Yeah.
We'll pick up in 2 weeks with Nag Sekunda.